You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 10th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today, I am on the road, but you still get fresh content. That's right. Today on the program, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charlie Savage on his essay about the difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in how they deal with executive authority and civil liberties. It's not quite as big of a difference as you might imagine, though. A fascinating conversation with Charlie Savage about the two different administrations' perspectives on presidential authority. And, of course, this is coming, folks, just after last week when the President of the United States assassinated, as far as we know, for the first time, an American citizen declaring unilateral authority to do so. Are you next? Probably not. But maybe the person to the left or right of you is. A very important conversation with Charlie Rose. And also, for members, you will be getting the panel I did at the Take Back the American Dream Conference down in Washington last week. It is a panel hosted by Nicole Sandler with myself, Cliff Schechter, Tom Hartman, and Tim Carr of Free Press, talking about independent media and our rights as consumers of media in this country. If you are not a member, but you contributed to the to sending me down there, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will provide you a link to the audio so that you can also enjoy it. And just so you know, for the rest of the week, we've got tomorrow on Tuesday, Mike Lofgren. He is a former 30-year veteran of Republican politics, working on the Hill for Republicans. He has since retired and essentially has said good riddance and gives the dirt on the Republican Party. Be sure to check that out on Wednesday. We will have Randall Kennedy, the author of The Color Line, a fascinating conversation about President Obama and race. On Thursday, I will be live from the Mass Torch Convention. Cliff Schechter will be joining us, and we'll have some other great guests down there. You know how much I love tort lawyers. They're the only people protecting us from corporate America when we have a government and regulatory agencies that are simply aren't doing the job. We'll be talking to some tort lawyers down there and other luminaries on Thursday and Friday. But for now, enjoy this talk I had with Charlie Savage. So, Charlie, let's first start with the gist of what your reporting that you've been doing basically since, I guess it was 2005, 2006, when you first noted the incredible and aggressive use of the Bush administration with signing statements. But before we get to that, let's just back up a little bit, because your essay is fascinating and not only talks about the substance of the difference in approaches by the Bush administration and the Obama administration to questions of executive power, particularly as how it relates to issues of not just the executive power across the board, but specifically in terms of national security issues. But you really have dedicated yourself to reporting about the debates that happen amongst the legal teams of the executive. Explain to us about that and why it's important.
Well, one of the lessons of the post 9/11 era has been that these internal executive branch arguments, especially in the realm of national security, are just incredibly important, because some of the most momentous things the government has done since 9/11 have been in the national security arena, where very often it's a secret to the public and the rest of the world what's actually happening, and or it's just not justiciable, so that if someone disagrees with it or thinks that's not what should be done, the courts have no jurisdiction over it, and so it cannot, you know, the legality can't be tested before some neutral arbiter. And very often it's been done unilaterally, so that the executive branch is doing it without going to Congress to specifically get permission and direction to do so. And so that means that the choke point within the system where something is going to be given the green light or the red light has very often turned out to be internal executive branch legal arguments, especially because in the national security realm and the counterterrorism realm, we saw this especially in the first few years after 9/11, there was such a desire to do whatever was possible to prevent another attack out of a fear that if some tool had been left on the table, some arrow left in the quiver, they actors in charge would have been blamed for not doing everything that could have been done, that once something was deemed legal, it was going to be done. And that's so the sort of the argument over whether this was a good idea as a matter of policy would be short-circuited, and instead the argument about whether what could lawfully be done was the only true deliberation that was going to take place. As we get further away from 9/11, maybe that's not as much the case anymore, but if there's another attack or attempted attack like the Christmas Day bombing in 2009, I think those impulses quickly reassert themselves. And so that means that these internal arguments are the moment in which important things are being decided, and to the extent that we in the media can figure out that these arguments are happening in real time or close to real time and flag them, and explain that these are the sort of difficult issues that people are wrestling with and why, that is the moment for, as a matter of sort of democratic governance, I think, that the public needs to know that something very important is possibly in the works.
And, you know, what I find so fascinating about this is that, you know, what we hear people talk about, the notion of the right often claims that they have a problem with judicial activism. And in some ways, this is a another form of genuine activism that is handled by the least accountable. It's almost, I mean, maybe this is too extreme, but this is almost another branch of governance in some respect in this very narrow area, because you have lawyers who are really essentially not accountable to Congress, not accountable to the judiciary, obviously not accountable to the people, barely accountable to the press, but for your dogged reporting. And yet they are creating new legal theories that expand the power of the executive.
Right. Well, I mean, they are accountable to the president, who's accountable to the people. So there's that. But this is, I mean,
But like, isn't this system almost in some way to short circuit that? Because the president, you know, as you say, is almost not making a policy decision here. They're reacting to what is deemed legal by elements within their administration.
That can be the dynamic. I think that we definitely saw that in particular in the early Bush years in the interrogation/torture debate that happened inside the Bush administration, you know, a couple of years before it surfaced in the public eye around the time of Abu Ghraib and the leaking of the various memos that had been written back in 2002 about that. But I think that part of what you're putting your finger on is sort of the deeper insight about all of this, is that in this realm where the executive branch can just act and it's not quite clear always, sometimes, like with the Libya intervention, it's quite clear what's happened, but sometimes it's not clear at all, it's a secret, and it's not justiciable and it's not going to go through the courts. The executive branch still, you know, has to obey the law, even if there's no mechanism for enforcing that, right? As Al Gore famously said, there's no controlling legal authority, but it has its internal procedures and processes that have developed over the years. And one of the things that's been fascinating about this era is the sort of realization of the extraordinary power that resides within this once obscure office in the Justice Department called the Office of Legal Counsel, which you said is almost like another branch of government, the executive branch lawyers. The Office of Legal Counsel is sometimes called the Supreme Court of the executive branch, the shadow Supreme Court, because it decides these legal issues and its opinions are binding on the rest of the government unless they get overruled by the Attorney General or the President. And so what's interesting about that in particular is that the President gets to appoint the people who are going to occupy that node of power within the government. And if the Office of Legal Counsel has said something is lawful, that means if you do something based on their opinion, you are safe from prosecution because the Justice Department has opined that what you did was not illegal. And that means they have the extraordinary responsibility to say no when the president wants to do something that's not legal. But when the president gets to appoint those figures, you can see the potential problems depending on who's getting appointed and when and sort of how much good faith lawyering is going to be done. And I think we've seen that waxes and wanes depending on the figures who are installed in that position at any given moment.
And one of the most fascinating points that you make in your essay is that your reporting not only shown some light on this process for the public and for members of Congress, for that matter, but you make the point that at least in the context of the Bush administration, what was happening out of the Office of Legal Counsel was also shrouded from other agencies that would normally participate, other lawyers, legal offices of other agencies that would normally participate in these decisions. And so it was even that much more insulated.
That's true. One of the critiques of this sort of decision-making process that surrounded OLC in late 01 and 02 and early 03 was that they broke down the usual interagency process by which lawyers and other chunks of the government that have some interest and expertise in the same topic, say the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, and so forth, would normally look at draft memorandums and comment on them and criticize them and argue about them, and they would all have to sign off on them. Ultimately, the OLC would make the final call. But that process is designed to have some degree of internal vetting, even if there's no external checks and balances on it. And one of the breakdowns of the sort of post-9/11 moment was that things were so secretive and so rushed that a lot of those lawyers were cut out. And to the extent they knew what was going on, they may have raised objections, but they were not heard. And so the problem of OLC structurally can be magnified depending on how the people running that office conduct themselves.
All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want you to discuss the other aspect of your essay, which essentially provides in two different models, a model of how to understand what happened to executive power and specifically in terms of national security legal policy during the Bush administration, and and the model in which to view the Obama administration on those same issues. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Charlie Savage. Okay. That's a fake break. And so, Charlie, when we broke in the last segment, we were talking in general about how the an executive branch, how a president essentially can and during the Bush administration did use their office of legal counsel and the power that resides in a small group of lawyers who, as you said, are almost as if they were the executive branch's Supreme Court. And so talk to us about how we can understand, and I understand this is obviously, you mentioned in your piece that it's difficult because for lay people to really fully grasp this, there's some oversimplification that happens. But talk to us, how do we understand what happened in the realm of executive power, and particularly in terms of national security, legal policy during the Bush administration, and then contrast that with how the Obama administration is dealing with it?
Right. Well, so I wrote a whole book about the Bush administration's record on executive power, the legal theories they put in motion and so forth, called Takeover. It came out in 07. And basically my thesis was that Dick Cheney had been in the White House, the Ford administration, right after Watergate in Vietnam, when Congress was sort of reining in the imperial presidency, so-called, that had risen up after during the early Cold War, was reimposing checks and balances in that sort of post-Watergate, post-Vietnam era, and that from the White House's perspective at the time, that was an outrage and needed to be rolled back, and that when he became an extremely influential vice president in the last administration, he was in a position to refight those battles and win them, and that a lot of the lawyers that were handpicked for the Office of Legal Counsel and the legal team in the Bush administration generally, at first, especially in the first few years, shared that view, and that a way to understand a variety of different policy moves and rhetorical statements that were made by the Bush administration in those years is that they were connected by a common desire, and that desire was to not just achieve the short-term policy issues that were in front of them, policy goals, but also to do so in a way that would protect and expand executive power. So you could have gone to Congress to adjust a federal statute in order to conduct a certain kind of surveillance, for example, or to hold people as a certain kind of prisoner. But it would be better to put that policy into motion unilaterally, to assert that you have a broad theory of commander-in-chief power, the president's inherent power to act in violation or of congressional laws and treaties. And then by doing that, by actually following through as putting the policy in motion, you not only achieve what you're trying to do, but you set a precedent. The precedent is a president has done this. That suggests the legal theories on which it was based were true. And so future presidents could also invoke those historical precedents when they, too, wanted to get around a statute or a treaty. So I think the Bush administration was in the business of creating executive power precedents.
Now, let me ask you, I mean, what's so fascinating about that, agenda is that where does this precedent live? In other words, you know, I understand the concept of we have precedent and that develops from the institution of the Supreme Court. But where does this precedent, what gives the validity to this precedent institutionally speaking?
Right. Well, so traditionally, in this sort of area, we think of precedents as a Supreme Court ruling. The court has interpreted the law to mean X. A majority of the Supreme Court has said that, and that's the answer, right? But this is different. This is historical precedent, because in this realm of executive branch unilateralism, places where things are not justiciable and will never come before the court, no such or very few such Supreme Court rulings are available. And so how executive branch lawyering often works is instead of citing court rulings, where they cite previous historical examples. In 1993, President Clinton did this. In 1987, President Reagan did that. In 1953, President Eisenhower did this. And so there's sort of this accretion of presidents basically pushing the envelope a little bit and getting away with it. And then that becomes the accepted interpretation because the president did it and showed it could be done. Therefore, it can be done again. And then the next president cites that as proposition that he can do that too, or maybe do it a little bit more because it's well established that the executive branch can do this. Look, it did it in these previous instances. But that's the precedent we're talking about.
The paradox, of course, is that much of this deliberation and much of the way that these are resolved, these questions are resolved, is obscured from the public. And it's almost as if, I mean, who's being convinced by this precedent, I guess, is the question. I mean, essentially, it's when a precedent is set by the Supreme Court, it becomes the law of the land, and it is in the public record. And you theoretically, because it's in the public record and because there is such transparency in this process, that at the very least, maybe not in the deliberative process, but at least in terms of the where it lands, there's an implied general acceptance by society. How does that work internally? I mean, does that make sense?
Yes, I see what you're saying. So if you have a series of secret moves that were undertaken by a president or secret memorandums drafted by the OLC in the past that have never been published or made public, how is it that the OLC today is drafting an opinion and it cites all these things and says, look, it's well established, this can be done, and we've long maintained it can be done, and here's our 13 previous opinions to that effect, but no one else has ever signed off on it, Congress has never signed off on it, the public doesn't even know about it. Is that really convincing or persuasive?
Right, and if you have a new group of OLC lawyers that come in, why should they necessarily give weight to one precedent over another?
Right. Well, so I think that they treat their jobs not unlike judges, in that they try to respect the idea of stare decisis. If something has been settled, unless there's a compelling reason, you don't reverse yourself. But every now and then, they do reverse themselves. And one of the things we saw at the end of the Bush administration, for example, and then at the beginning of the Obama administration, was OLC and the new lawyers who were there in 07, 08, 09 were rescinding opinions by the early Bush lawyers, especially on matters like torture. In fact, the first time that happened, it was in March of 04, when a new OLC head named Jack Goldsmith had come in and was refusing to sign off on what became known as the warrantless surveillance or terrorist surveillance program. And this resulted in the famous Ashcroft hospital room incident when the entire Justice Department nearly resigned when Bush overrode its view that this continuing that program would be illegal. So sometimes they do reverse themselves. But this is the general practice in this elm is there is not much judicial precedent to look for. So let's look for historical practice, historical events, previous opinions by this office.
All right. So sadly, Charlie, we're starting to run out of time here. But briefly, if the Bush administration was about expanding executive power, how would you characterize the Obama administration in this realm that we've been talking?
Right. So in this essay, Power Wars, that prompted you to want to talk to me today, I sort of lay out a model for understanding the Obama team as well. And the argument is that they came into office in the wake of this Bush experience wanting to show that they would respect the rule of law, but that they still believed that this was a war with al-Qaeda, not a criminal law enforcement matter. They wanted to show you could fight a war against a terrorist network while within a framework of law. And that often meant couching their memorandums and doing everything pursuant to congressional authorization and federal statutes and saying that this was okay because Congress had said it was okay, as opposed to because the president, as commander-in-chief, could set his own rules. And it was easy for them to do that, especially the first few years, for a couple of reasons, one of which was the Democrats controlled Congress, so there was sort of a sympathetic branch over there. And two was, in the late Bush administration, there had been a great normalization of a lot of these policies. The Bush administration had gone to Congress for things like military commissions and surveillance and won legislation that adjusted federal statutes to make them dovetail with these policies. And so a lot of the rule of law concerns, the concerns that, hey, a president can't do this if a statute says he can't, notwithstanding whatever theory he says is true, had fallen away by 09, 010. And so some of the continuity we've seen with the Obama team that has distressed people on the left, and the civil libertarian left, is, I argue, the result of a bit of a confusion of two different strands of critique during the Bush years. One was the rule of law critique, which is the president has to obey the law, and one was the civil libertarian critique, which is the government ought not be doing these things, whether or not Congress has blessed them, because it's a matter of individual rights. You want judges to sign off on warrants. You don't want torture, et cetera. And so when the rule of law concerns were drained away, the civil libertarian concerns largely remained. And that's one way to understand the sort of disillusionment among some elements of the left about what it was that Obama did and didn't do when he came in as a supposed agent of change. And then my last thought in the essay, which obviously has more time to explore, is that this year and going forward, with the loss to the Republicans of the House of Representatives and the Congress becoming much more of an obstacle to the president and enacting restrictions on detainee transfers and other things he might want to do, I think we're seeing a turn toward greater willingness to act unilaterally than we saw those first 2 years. And so that model may be breaking down. We saw that with the Libya war. We saw that with this no longer defending the Defense of Marriage Act in court to sort of set the stage for it to be found unconstitutional, as in contrast to going through Congress to get a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I predict that we'll see more of that in the rest of his term and the second term if he gets reelected.
Charlie Savage, it's a fascinating essay. It's available on Amazon. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can support the Majority Report by becoming a member at majority.fm. In fact, it's only your support that can keep this show going. I know there are thousands, literally thousands of you who listen to the show on a daily basis for free. If you can afford to become a member, I highly encourage you to do so, so that we can continue to bring you interviews like this with Charlie Savage. You won't hear a 30-minute, 25-minute, whatever long interview it was with Charlie Savage in any other medium, folks. You just won't hear it. And so if you can become a member, please do. You can always support the show by buying your junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Find the link, bookmark it, buy all your crap from Amazon through us. We get a kickback. You can also support the show by, of course, buying your coffee, tea, and chocolate at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. And support us by donating your account at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. For members, stick around. You're going to get another almost hour of bonus material. That's the panel that I did at the Campaign for America's Future conference last week. And stick around. This week we'll have updates on Occupy Wall Street and Occupy fill in the blank. It's happening all across America. We'll talk to you soon.